You have to answer for this nerd podcast mafia, Dave. You fingered her podcast to be associated with Dork of All Trades and Geek Yogurt?
Ben, you got it all wrong.
Ah, that little farce you played with old Johnny. You think that'll fool the beard?
It's innocent. I swear on our podcast.
Sit down.
Please, the Nerd Podcast Mafia. They're good people. A respectable group of like-minded podcasts that support and promote each other. I listen to So Wizard and Fans on Patrol all the time. And there are a number of other great podcasts in the mix. Just check them out at nerdpodcastmafia.com for yourself.
You make me an offer I cannot refuse.
Thank you. Now leave the cape. Take a cannoli.
Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of three opinionated guys with mics and too much free time. Strong enough to stop a speeding movie rumor, more powerful than a bad comic book event. Able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have better things to do. It's Dave, Ben, and John. It's Superhero Speak.
Hey everyone, you're listening to Superhero Speak, and I'm your host Dave.
And John.
And this week, boys and girls, we have another great guest with us. He's a comic book writer. He's worked for Marvel on Guardians of Infinity. He works on several independent books, including, oh, I'm going to make sure I say this right, No Angel? That's the name,
yep.
Correct? All right, with his sister. And everyone, welcome Eric Pilecki to the show.
Hey, how are you guys today?
Oh, we're doing good. So you're in Seattle?
That's correct. But only for about the last 6 months.
Oh, okay. How's the weather out there, though?
It's actually been beautiful. It's rained a little bit today.
Of course.
True to the stereotype, but the sun is shining right now, or it has only recently started to set out here on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. And it's been down for a while here on the East Coast. It was a little warm today, but you know, can't complain. It's better than rainy like it was last week. So something that we usually, you know, I mean, so you're a comic book writer, and the question we usually kind of like to start with is that something that you've always wanted to do? Have you always wanted to be a comic book writer?
I think so, whether I knew it or not.
Okay.
I was a comic book fan as a kid, you know, all the way up through about my freshman year in high school when I realized that as cool as comic books were, girls were a little bit of a better option to spend my money on.
Just a little.
Or so I thought at the time.
There you go.
but in college, I went to school initially in engineering. And after about a year, I realized I didn't want to build spaceships. I just wanted to write stories about spaceships.
Uh-huh.
So I switched over to English, thinking that I was going to be a fancy, you know, popular novelist. I was going to be the Ohio's own Stephen King. But I found that I didn't really have the patience to write prose.
Right.
And a friend of mine about that time had given me a copy of the first Authority trade paperback, which, you know, immediately got me interested in comic books again. But also conveniently, they had printed in the back of that particular edition of the trade paperback Warren Ellis's script for the first issue.
Mm.
And so that was a really, like, I looked at that, I read it, you know, compared it to the issue itself and realized, well, hell, I can do this. And the rest is history. So, you know, fast forward, you know, 15 years later when I finally started to get things published.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely is a long road. So I wasn't sure, what did you work on before you worked at Marvel?
So I have been doing some independent stuff. I had put up some short web comics that I have since hidden all the way back in 2006. Nuked their existence from orbit. But beginning in around 2013 or so, I started pursuing this in earnest, and I ran a Kickstarter for an independently published graphic novel called Orphans,
mm-hmm.
which was really my love letter to that Warren Ellis stuff that got me back into comics. And, you know, we raised, I think, $12,000 to put that book out.
Oh, wow.
Most of which, of course, I used to help pay the artist who I worked with.
Mm-hmm.
And I followed that up with a second Kickstarter for another graphic novel called Red Angel Dragnet, which was more of an action horror. And if Orphans was my love letter to Warren Ellis, then Red Angel Dragnet was my love letter to Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Supernatural and all of that kind of, it's not really horror, but it kind of touches on, you know, the dark fantastical.
Right, right.
And then with those two books out in the ether, this was about 2014, 2015, I started shopping what would be my third graphic novel called Fake Empire. And this one I didn't have to kickstart. I was able to publish it through a company called Darby Pop Publishing, who at the time that I pitched it to them, they were publishing as a sub-imprint of IDW, later moved to Magnetic Press when my book came out, and then actually just today announced that they were going solo.
Oh,
so,
okay. Cool. And I guess, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, yes. And that's where I was going to go, was that work kind of got me a little bit on Marvel's radar.
Mm-hmm.
I had met an editor or two at San Diego in 2015, and they'd asked, like, hey, we got to talk, and I mentioned I was a comic book writer, and they said, well, send me your best work, and we'll take a look. And I, of course, did so, assuming that, you know, it was going to end up in somebody's spam filter. But then someone got in touch with me and asked me to do a 15-page story as a backup in Guardians of Infinity number 6. And, you know, I got to do a story spotlighting Gamora and Kitty Pryde.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, Kitty Pryde was really one of my gateway characters into comics the first time I was reading them as a kid. So that was, you know, no pressure there. And, you know, so that got me on Marvel's radar. And then around the same time, Black Mask, Greenlit, No Angel, and here we are.
Right. Cool. So, okay.
Sorry, that was a really long-winded. That was the annotated history of Eric Palicki. So sorry about that.
No
problem. We'll turn into the abridged edition when we go live with this.
No. No, I mean, and that's actually a pretty straightforward journey. A lot of creators sometimes take weird turns to get there. I'm kind of curious when you write one of the backup stories in an issue, how does that work? Do they tell you what the main script is and you work around that, or it's just you wrote your story, submitted it, and then they made it work in the book?
So the way that Guardians of Infinity worked was it was by design a book with two stories in it. And the first story in every issue was an ongoing adventure
mm-hmm.
Written by Dan Abnett, who was, of course, one of the original – well, one of the first architects of Guardians of the Galaxy as we know them today, not to be confused with the weird future team that Jim Valentino wrote and drew in the 90s. But he had done this story that was kind of tying in those guardians from the future with Drax and Groot and Rocket, and then a third team from 1,000 years in the past. So there was some familiarity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had your Rocket and your Drax and your Groot that everyone was familiar with, and then a lot of characters that no one either had ever seen before or had seen in 20 years. So what they wanted to do was to include these backup stories that focused on and spotlighted some of the current team of Guardians so that they could then, you know, pitch it to the people who were coming to Guardians after the movie and wanted to see a Star-Lord story or wanted to see a Gamora story or wanted to see, you know, some of the characters, because at the time Flash Thompson's Venom and The Thing and Kitty Pryde were all part of the team. So they said to me was, we would like you to do a spotlight story starring two or three of the Guardians, and possibly if you wanted to bring in, you know, a character from from outside. You know, a couple of other people during the course of this, you know, had, you know, brought in the Human Torch because of the Thing connection, or Spider-Man because of the Venom connection.
Right, right.
But, you know, I, of course, jumped on the idea of doing, you know, the two female characters together. It was a really great opportunity.
Right, right.
Do you get to pick, or, I mean, they said you could pick, but is it really like you pick just about anybody you want, or they have to work off of continuity, or do they, like, give you a list?
Well, they had just said, you know, that's what they want. They wanted two or more of the current roster of Guardians. Send us your best pitches. And I think I pitched them three stories, and they picked their favorite from among them, and then I wrote up the script, and it was a pretty straightforward process. They did very little editing of me, which was great.
Good. Yeah.
That's unusual almost, I think.
I mean, it helped that I was, you know, a 15-page backup in the second Guardians story. So it wasn't like I was writing, you know, continuity threads that Bendis was going to have to deal with the next month or whatever. But it was interesting because, you know, they did ask me to fold in some of the current continuity. There was a crossover with the all-new X-Men had just wrapped up. So Gamora at that time had, and I'm doing finger quotes here, cosmic powers, whatever that means. In fact, the editor said, whatever that means. So, you know, we had to acknowledge that in our story.
Right. Just like the power cosmic, whenever Spider-Man had that one point, and it seemed like he could do anything. I don't know if that was a good thing or not. So, No Angel, that's the book that you currently are working on. You have two issues out so far?
Three issues. Third issue just came out last Wednesday.
Oh, cool. So for the people listening who aren't familiar with the book, can you give us the elevator pitch?
Sure. The elevator pitch is it's the story of a woman who comes home to bury her murdered father and brother, and she involves herself in the murder investigation and discovers that her father was leading a secret second life. And as part of the secrets he was keeping, he was part of an organization trying to prove the existence of angels.
Okay.
That sounds more like a cult than an actual organization.
That's very fair. That's very fair. That's actually a discussion that the characters have in the second issue about what constitutes a cult. if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck.
Right.
But the editors pitched it around, and I didn't write any of the copy for the Diamond Solicits, but they pitched it as Preacher meets Justified, which is a terrible, terrible thing to, as a, you know, a relatively neophyte writer, to have to live up to comparison to those two projects.
Yeah, I can see that. You write the book with your sister, so that's something I'm a little curious about. Not only is it a creative person that you're working with, but it's a sibling. So how does that kind of relationship work out?
Actually, it couldn't have gone more smoothly. Mm-hmm. Like, I have attempted co-writing endeavors in the past, and they've gone terribly. But with Adrienne, it was incredibly smooth, and mostly it was because she recognized that I'm the one who does the comic scripting and is familiar with the art of comic scripting and storytelling. Okay. So once I flew out to her house. She lives in Los Angeles, and we worked out the story beats and I came back with an outline and wrote the scripts. Then I sent them to her and she came back with notes. So that was basically our process, and it was very smooth. Most of her notes, for those that don't know, she's an actress.
Mm-hmm.
So most of her notes were kind of distilled through that sort of Hollywood lens, like what's the romantic lead, and lot of that, like the things that you see in every kind of typical stereotypical television show or Hollywood movie.
Right.
And the nice thing about comics, specifically working with Black Mask, is where appropriate, we're able to throw those notes out the window, because telling a good story is more important than telling a Hollywood sanitized version of the story.
Right, right. That's interesting. I like that. I'm trying to put this nicely because I've worked with my brothers on stuff. I was in a band with my brother for years. Is there ever any, you know, like she gives you notes and you throw it away and she goes, oh, you're just doing that because, you know, you're mad about this. You know, like I said, the sibling rivalry kind of stuff that goes on. And if that comes up, how do you guys like stop what you're doing, resolve that issue and move on?
I mean, there were a couple of late night phone calls, it gets tough because just like this call we're having right now, I was living in Ohio at the time, so I was three time zones away.
Okay.
And so they were late night for me and not so much for her. But just, you know, you sort of have to make your argument and, you know, you pick your battles.
Right.
I mean, and it's just like working with an editor. You know, I had similar experiences working the first time I worked with an editor after having self-published my first two books. You know, working with a publisher that's going to tell you, well, you know, we can't really get away with this because we're trying to, you know, keep the book PG-13, so you can't use the F word 14 times on this page, Eric. So I get it, and you pick your battles and what's really important to you from a story perspective. What does it affect the story, you know, if I kind of want to compromise here, am I really impacting the story all that negatively?
Right. Cool. And then who does the art on the book?
His name is Ari Sayarazad.
Okay.
Right?
Sorry. Yeah. I saw that last name and I was wondering how to pronounce it. But go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I've been talking a lot.
Oh, no. Well, that's kind of the point. But I was going to say that we hear a lot of horror stories about artists looking for writers and writers looking for artists. So what's your story? How'd you get him and what'd you have to through to find a guy who, you know, was able to do the artwork that you were looking for?
So I reached out through digital webbing. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that website.
No, that's a new one.
So it has been a hub for creators looking for collaborators for years and years and years. In fact, if you go to that website now, it still looks like it did in 1998 or so. So it's still got that very kind of Spartan bulletin board vibe to it.
Right.
And there are a couple of threads where, you know, it's writers seeking artists, you know, and then you've got a thread for paid versus unpaid. And things like that. And I reached out, I just posted, hey, I'm looking to do this book. And this was actually, we did the first issue almost, it was early 2015. So I held on to the book for almost a year before it was greenlit. And thankfully, as talented an artist as Ari is, no one had picked him up in the interim. You know, no one had, you know, he hadn't attached himself to any long-term projects in the interim. Because he drew the first issue, and then we waited about a year to get a green light from someone. Had a couple of suitors, but I ultimately went with Black Mass just because I like the people that run the company as well as their catalog of books.
Cool. And does I guess you guys like is he located in the United States? And
he's in Indonesia.
Okay.
And,
okay.
Reached out to me. You know. He reached out to me about 3 weeks ago for, you know, being Indonesian and an artist in comics, just to make very clear to me that he didn't give a damn about politics and, you know, the Easter eggs and hidden messages that you're going to find in our book are, you know, he's really into American music, so he's hidden a lot of music references.
So,
well, that's cool.
So no anti-Semitic or no anti-Christian or Semitic messages hidden in your book. That's good for the listeners to know. They don't need to worry about that.
But I mean, he was terrified. Like he was, no, he said, like, I'm really sorry that I've been hiding these music eggs. I really feel nervous about having done that, even, you know, because of the sudden shift in the climate,
right?
With artists from Indonesia because of the X-Men Gold debacle.
Now, yeah, I can see that, and you know, but and that's the thing too. I mean, given what was hidden in those books, the average person isn't going to know what they were looking at. You know, it's somebody who has to know the Quran and know those writing specific writings to know what the message was, you know. So I understand how that got snuck by, and I can understand how other artists are scared now. But, you know, I guess if you find someone that you trust and you can work with, it shouldn't
and
be...
And besides, if he's hiding references to, like, music, okay, unless the music was all Ted Nugent, I can't see it being controversial. But, you know, or ABBA, you know, it was all ABBA, that would be actually kind of off-putting. That's not a bad thing. I just had to look at the X-Men Gold thing to know what that was.
Oh my god. And I like the MK, so quiet.
I saw it in 95.
Yeah.
Well, it was 14, but it was probably great.
All right.
That's a good age to be at a concert.
I guess so.
They're more fun.
Yeah, well, that's true. So the reason I was asking where he's located, so everything is then obviously done through the internet, through mail. Is there ever... regardless of the hidden music images, is there are you ever afraid of issues with, like, getting the art in a timely manner or getting your message out, getting an edit you want to him get to him quickly in a timely manner, you know?
You know, just with electronic mail, you know, What the hell is wrong with me? I sound like I was way older than 14 in 1995 saying electronic mail. With email and the internet generally, and, you know, being able to jump on, you know, Facebook Messenger or Skype or, you know, GChat or whatever, it's really easy to communicate with artists in real time, no matter where they are in the world. My only concern early on when I was doing this, but much less so now, is that... because of things like digital webbing that has let me reach out to artists internationally, is that in most cases, English isn't their first language.
Okay. Oh, right.
So, and, you know, given that, you know, Arias is Indonesian, and Brinko, who drew Orphans, is for Serbia, and Anna, who did Red Angel Dragnet, is in Poland.
Dang.
And even the artist, the Marvel story I wrote, is in Italy. And he's the only one I've met in person, so you're kind of gone. But it's in that, you know, like, I assume that he's, you know, he's a great guy and a young guy, but, like, to hear him talk, I assume that right after our conversation, he went down into the sewers to step on a bunch of turtles. Save the princess in the Mushroom Kingdom. I don't know. Is that terrible?
No.
You guys can cut that out if you think that's terrible.
No, it made us laugh, so it's not terrible.
No, he's, that's my only concern. And, you know, there have been... I can probably count on one hand the times when I've actually ever had to request an edit from an artist.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
So,
but given that they have to know, I mean, basically they have to know a little English, don't they? Because if you're requesting an artist for a comic book that's in English, right? I mean, they'd have to be able to read it in order to be able to know what to draw, or listen to you and talk it over with you to know what to draw, right? Or am I missing something?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, by the time we get to the point where, like, we're actually collaborating, I have a pretty good grasp of their grasp of English.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, communicated by emails half a dozen times. And, I mean, even just in their initial, you know, if I put a post on a message board saying, hey, I'm looking for an artist to collaborate with, and someone comes back, I can generally tell, you know, how smoothly it's going to go. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it's 2017, and, you know, English is, you know... I say this without ego or arrogance, English is a really common language worldwide, and a lot of people are learning it even if it's not their first language. And a lot of them, I think, have, you know, they either use a translation service or, you know, if it gets too complex, they run it through Google Translate.
Right. Well, I mean, actually, I wanted to say the reason that I ask questions like this is I feel that there's a lot of people listening to this podcast who might be thinking about, you know, jumping in the water and starting their own book. And they might be afraid to go out and try to find an artist, especially they might go to a website like this and get people from Indonesia who say, oh, yeah, I'll work with you. They might be afraid to work with them because they're not, you know, in the same country or not speaking the same native tongue. And, you know, what I get a lot from people is that it's really not that hard, especially today in the, you know, with the world of the internet and communication and instant gratification, as it were.
Yeah.
The world's a much smaller place.
And given what you've said, it's like the number of countries you just mentioned of people that you've worked with. I mean, three more countries, I think you get a free Sunday. Like, just, I mean, it sounds like the barrier to finding people to collaborate with is basically how much time you spend rather than anything cultural or geographical or lingual. So there's that.
So, all right. So if I forget, I have to ask this, or both Troy and Steve probably be upset with me. You are working on a story for Terminal, correct?
Yes, I have a story. I'm collaborating with an artist named Andy Rummel. Our story is slated to be in Terminal number 3. And I think that we are sharing space with Justin Gray, which is in itself a really cool thing. Because, mm-hmm. you know, I love Justin's solo work and his collaborations with Jimmy Palmiotti. But the story that Andy and I are doing is a story called Oubliette, and it is it's a murder mystery, and it's the protagonist only exists when no one is looking at him.
Okay.
So
is that from, what was it, the Mystery Men?
Mystery Men.
Well, Mystery, you know, there was an element of. Think about the guy who in the invisible, no one was looking at him. It's kind of the reverse of that. No, I can't cop to Silan for Mystery Men, because my story is any but a comedy.
Okay.
Ooh. Okay. It's an interesting.
So that's a great deep reference.
There's, you know, that's about all our deep references. But I can't even imagine how that would work. Just, I mean, would you want to be saved? Close your eyes. I mean. How did you even come up with that?
Actually, I wanted to, and I feel bad for Andy based on because there's a little degree of difficulty. Like, how do you make that work? Yeah. Especially, how do you convey that in comics? And there's a backstory to this character, how he developed this condition. And there's a cop element. He recruits a New York police officer to help him,
mm-hmm.
and does so by. It's done with mirrors, to borrow the cliche. It's actually done with mirrors. So I don't want to say too much because I'm really proud of the story, and I think that, you know, that's a pretty decent hook. So I don't want to give away the tricks.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, this is what I love about talking with like a lot of independents and smaller artists and authors is because you would not get ideas like this past anybody at DC or Marvel. Or if you did, you'd have to be somebody's nephew, I think. It's great to see like stuff. I mean, okay. You've got an excellent hook. I want to read now because I want to figure out how the hell that works. But, I mean, it's just nice to hear all these very strange and really incredible ideas that come up every, you know, from all these different sources that we wouldn't get if we didn't have the kind of situation we have today with self-publishing or small publishers that are banding together, that sort of thing, man. Is that what you're finding, that you're seeing, you're getting more chances to run with your ideas?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the beauty of, you know, in 2017, like my first two books are available through Comixology on their submit program. And that alone has been a game changer. I don't think that I'd still be trying to make comics if not for that opportunity, for being able to, you know, to have my books out there for more than just, you know, the 200 or so people that backed each of my Kickstarters. And so, like, if there's an idea that you have, no matter how outlandish, you can do it, and whether it's through Kickstarter to raise the funds to put it out into the world, or something like Comixology Submit, where you have a platform that you can sell it to potential readers, it's never been easier to make and then, you know, get some income back mm-hmm. from making the ideas. And it's, you know, you can kind of use it as your own personal sort of skunk works. And no matter how outlandish the idea, you can throw it out there and see if it works.
And if you get traction, you get money in your account, and then you can go farther with it, which is awesome.
Right. And then you can just go on to the next crazy idea.
To back up what John was saying is too, it's funny because, you know, so many people complain there aren't any original ideas out there. And the problem is there are original ideas out there. Just, as you alluded to a little bit earlier with the Hollywood lens, they just want to spit the same things out over and over again because they know they're successful.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I can rant on, you know, I mean, Brian Hibbs wrote a really interesting, I don't want to, you know, I can neither condemn nor praise it too much, his analysis of what Marvel is doing or what he feels Marvel is doing wrong at the moment. And he makes a lot of insightful points. And
That's Marvel coming after you now.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry about that. You know, but like we're at this point where you're selling a lot of comics to a lot of different audiences. And I totally lost the thread of what I was trying to say, but that was the ding on my my computer screwed me over. But you know, we are selling to a lot of different audiences, and so, you know, for better or for worse, Spider-Man punching one of the same half dozen bad guys, or Batman punching one of the same half dozen bad guys across half a dozen different books every month isn't going to cut it anymore, because people do want mm-hmm. a little bit more of a varied selection of options, whether it's the characters or the situations or a little bit of both.
No, I definitely agree with that. And I do think, you know, I mean, we live in a time where television has become a lot more segmented and, you know, with millions of channels now and Netflix and Hulu and all these options, and all of them having original content on them. And I think it's because of that we're seeing people branching out in their comic book interests too. You know, I think, you know, checking out more and more what Image and IDW and Dark Horse is doing and Zenoscope and all the other smaller publishers, and then even I see buzz around books like the Terminal Project, and I see buzz around No Angel and some of the smaller press and Source Point Press. These guys we started talking with last year, but there's a lot of buzz around their titles, you know. So it's like you said, it's audiences are finding more what they actually want to read instead of just Batman punching the Joker every week.
Hey, here's a question for you. You went to New York Comic Con last year, right?
Yes.
So how did you find that? I mean, I probably passed your, I probably passed you quite a few times while I was there. But there were a lot of independents there. And I mean, how did you get a lot of people to your booth looking at your stuff?
I did. I had an advantage of, we debuted No Angel at New York Comic Con. So the first issue didn't officially launch in shops until November 30th of last year, but we had advanced copies of number one with a New York Comic Con exclusive cover. So I had a pretty good and steady crowd of people coming to my Artist Alley table for that, because of the collectability aspect of it. Mm-hmm. But I did get a lot of crossover. People came for that, and they also picked up, you know, one of my self-published trades or Fake Empire, mm-hmm. which was my Darby Pop book. So it was a really good experience and an opportunity to cross-promote. You know, and then there were the people who I'm sure showed up at, you know, 11:05 on Thursday morning, bought the copy, and then walked immediately over to the CGC table to send the book out for grading. But that is an aspect of the industry that I don't personally adhere to. But if you know, the collectability and having a slabbed 9.8 grade issue of your favorite books is what makes you happy, then I'm super glad you're buying comics.
Yeah, I guess we learned nothing from the 90s.
So says the 10 Robin number ones and 10 Man of Steel number ones in my basement. But
So I'm kind of curious. You were in Artist Alley. Where about in Artist Alley?
I shared a table with my very good friend Jenny Wood, who Jenny does a book with 215 Inc. called Flutter. It's actually a three-volume graphic novel series. And I did not qualify for a table last year, but she was gracious enough to share her space with me. And it was a really great experience. We were towards the back row K, maybe.
Okay. No, it's just because I usually end up working it every year at my friend's table, and he's at J18. So I'm just kind of thinking, you know, where you might have been. If I probably could have been looking at you all weekend and didn't realize.
I did pass you, I'm pretty sure, quite a few times.
Now we feel
That's
bad.
That's okay.
Now,
that's okay. You'll just have to find me this year.
Did you qualify this year?
They have not announced Artist Alley table placements yet. And I know that there's some concern because Artist Alley is being moved and possibly downsized. Although I spoke with a ReadPop representative at C2E2, and she assured me that the space, they're tearing out some of the soft walls that ordinarily, you know, they use to segment panel rooms. Mm-hmm. So that the space is actually the same size square footage wise, but I will remain unconvinced until I actually get in there and see the space.
It's not a matter of same space square footage wise. It's being sequestered in our own little area. I completely enjoyed that aspect of it because it's like the people that are really interested in comic books are the ones that journey down there. You know, now if we're like next to the celebrities,
oh, that's true.
You know, that's going to be a mess. Or if we're up on the floor, it's like, how's that going to be?
As long as it's not on the floor, because if you've ever tried to go anywhere on the floor on a Saturday.
Yeah, well, yeah, we did. I nearly missed two interviews because of that traffic. Yeah, I've been through like, I've been in New York at, you know, during like, what is it, gatherings and such, and I've never gotten to that point where I literally had to stand there and wait for somebody half a quarter mile away from me to move so the line could start again. It was unbelievable, especially in the back on the main floor. But the Artist Alley Artist Alley was hitting the whole convention, so you must have gotten some pretty good foot traffic too.
Yeah, it was great. It's I am not one to measure Artist Alley success based on my sales. I would much rather just interface with people and be able to pitch my books and talk about comics generally. So as long as I can break even or close to even, that's what's important to me. But I made I made more money on Thursday than I have at any other entire convention I've ever tabled at.
Nice. Is that part of the reason why No Angel sold out by December 13th?
I'd like to think so. I think that, again, you know, my sister has a modest fan base,
yes.
Or a better than modest fan base, and I think that we got a lot of readers because of her involvement.
All right.
So yeah.
Okay. So since you brought her up, I mean, those who don't know who your sister is, she obviously she played Mockingbird on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. She was Wonder Woman in the failed pilot. So she has some geek cred, as an actress. And, so I was going to ask you, cause like when I was looking up information about you before, tonight and looking up like No Angel, like you go to, Entertainment Weekly's webpage and there's an article about your book, but of course there's a giant picture of your sister at the top.
Yeah, that's kind
of, how does stuff like that play into you know, your relationship and be your own feelings. And if you don't want to answer that, I perfectly understand, but I'm just kind of curious.
Oh, I have no problem with it. I mean, you know, this was a measured, you know, writing a book with her, knowing that, you know, she has the geek cred between, you know, the two that you mentioned, plus, you know, she was in the second G.I. Joe movie as Lady J. Was in, you know, as far as failed DC pilots goes, she was also in the
she was in the Aquaman,
Aquaman pilot, right? As well. She had a one-time guest appearance on Smallville. So she's been all over. She was in the pilot. She's Sam's girlfriend in the Supernatural pilot.
Yep.
So, you know, we knew, you know, who the bigger name on the book was going to be. And I have no problem with that. And she has no problem, you know, she'll, in interviews where she talks about the book, she's, you know, she's quick to give me credit, probably more than I deserve for our collaboration. But like she, you know, she literally or really contributed to the book. You know, I've been accused of, you know, stunt casting the co-writer in the past. And like this really was a true collaboration. I mean, there are things in the book that are very personal to both of us. Thematically, it's a story about family. And, you know, what better themes to tackle if you're co-writing with your sibling than family?
Right, right. And I definitely want to accuse you of that. I mean, somebody who has had three or four self-published and small published books, then got to write a backup story in a Marvel book. So you're on the comic radar. To sit there and say you're doing stunt casting at this point doesn't make sense.
If you can't credit yourself.
If you were coming out of nowhere and wanted to write the story and said, write it with me, then I could see that, you know. But you already had a level of comic book success before you went into this story.
I mean, we have been close most of our adult lives. You know, we didn't, as most siblings are, and you know, you said you have, you know, you've collaborated with your brothers in the past. As most siblings are, we didn't get along when we both lived under the same roof, but since have become very close. So, like, this was an opportunity I was looking forward to tell a story with you know, one of my best friends on the planet. So we got to do this book.
Well, that's good.
That's awesome.
And excited for I'm excited that the response, by and large, the critical response to the book has mostly been positive. And, you know, there were a lot of eyes, especially on the first issue, because of Adrian's involvement. But the critical response has been overwhelmingly positive. So,
yeah, I'm on a comic book roundup right now. And it's the first two issues got like an 8 out of 10, which, you know.
Right.
That was, you know.
Yeah, I think like, between the two issues, there's only one. As far as comic book roundups, no metric starts only one.
Okay,
and you can get them. You can get them on. You have to get more people to go onto Amazon.com and to review your books. It's only got one review there, but it's perfect.
Well, I'll thank my mom. Comes here.
So, and for those who don't know, comic book roundup is kind of like the what's the one movie. Right for comics. So actually, you just mentioned your mother. So that's another question. Obviously, both you and your sister are in creative fields. Was that encouraged in your house growing up?
I'm trying to decide how honestly I should answer that. It's going to depend on how much I'll share this. No, so.
Well, it depends if you think your mother's going to listen to this or not.
She will absolutely listen. And she is wonderful, and they have always been supportive. But my mother's support has always been appropriately measured in that, you know, she always is concerned that we're being taken, you know, she wants to make sure we're not being taken advantage of. So she always is, you know, she always asks these questions about, I'll come to her and say, hey, I'm getting published by, you know, X, Y, and Z publisher, and she'll, you know, her first question will be like, so how much are you getting paid? which is fair. And, you know, with the comics thing especially, and, you know, Adrian took a huge risk. She moved out to LA right out of high school and worked, you know, worked as a bartender and as a, you know, as a Subway sandwich artist for years before finally getting, you know, her foot in the door. But I have a day job. And, you know, my mother is extremely – she's supportive of the comics thing as far as it goes, but is also likes to remind me that it's important to hang on to the day job and all of the things that come with having a 9-to-5, the benefits and the, you know, the 401k and things like that. So it's hard to say – like – in the moment, it's very frustrating, even though I recognize that it's coming from a good place. Like, no, I just want to sit at home and make comic books all day, Mom. But she's smart enough to at least remind me, sometimes to a fault, that that's not necessarily the smartest course of action.
I totally understand. You know, I wanted to pursue. Wow, I wanted to pursue music since I was in seventh grade. You know, and it was always, oh, that's great, but what do you have to fall back on? You know, and I don't know. I mean, sometimes, you know, I'm happy with the way my life turned out, but there are times where it's like, wow, I wish I was, you know, playing in front of 50,000 people tonight. But, you know, c'est la vie, right?
Yeah, c'est la vie.
mothers know best.
Right. And do you still make music in your spare time? Do you still noodle on the guitar or whatever whatever your poison may be?
Yes. Yeah. No. Definitely. In fact, I have a John can attest to this because before we bring the guest on, I'll be sitting here playing around with my guitar. It's always sitting next to my computer. So, yeah, whenever I get a chance. Okay, what was I gonna? Oh, wow, my mind is blank.
That's two down.
What is the? Oh, okay. What is your overall plan for No Angel? You're on issue 3 at this point. Do you have Do you have a plan for so many issues and then do a collected edition, or do you want to just keep going with it? Do you have an endpoint in mind? What's the thought process?
So issue 4 will wrap up our first story, and it's. Mm-hmm. It's a good punctuation mark on the first arc of the story, but it's definitely open ended. Right. You know, and we would love to continue. It's going to depend on where sales are and everything. I'm not leaving readers hanging, or we're not leaving readers hanging. I should say I shouldn't speak for
right.
Adrian and as well as Ari and the rest of the creative team. But, you know, we'll definitely do a collected edition through Black Mask at that point. And then we'll come back and we'll see where things are. And one thing that I've been accused of, not just with this collaboration, but my other books, is that I tend to write very open-ended endings. And so what I get a lot, I mean, in so much as, you know, an indie creator gets a lot of anything is, you know, this really feels like it's a pilot episode. Like you're just putting this out there as a pitch to sell it to Hollywood. And that's not the case.
Right.
You know, I mean, I'm not going to turn down that kind of money, but that's never in the forefront of my mind when I'm writing a story. What it is, the reason I leave those open-ended endings is because I want to come back and tell more of this story. So it's a pilot episode in terms of like, being able to like come back to a larger narrative, but it's not really a pilot episode. You know, it's not really my blueprint for, you know, what this cool new Netflix show I'm pitching is.
Right, right. No, I get that. Maybe you could liken it to the first Star Wars movie, because George Lucas never knew if he was going to be able to continue on with the story. So it could have ended there. But he left it open-ended enough that, you know, we could get Empire and Jedi. If it was successful or if he ever wanted to go back and revisit the characters. But, you know, when you really think about A New Hope or the original's first movie, it is a self-contained story that could end right blowing up the Death Star.
Yeah, and that's absolutely how, you know, Lord knows that I'm of a man of a certain age, so you know, Star Wars is the story of Star Wars is in the back of my head every time I put pen to paper. So, you know, I mean, that's pretty much cool. my very first crush was on Carrie Fisher in the original Star Wars.
Who wasn't back then? I mean,
exactly.
I was going to say who wasn't. I definitely think the three of us all could say we share that.
She's the original princess.
Right. And I mean, and I'm talking Star Wars era. Like I was really into the cinnamon buns. Didn't have a problem with those at all when I was 5.
I know, but it got better with the gold bikini.
I got to ask. Like I'm hearing that more and more from some of the independents that we interview that it seems like this idea of of writing a comic, even if it's their like first comic, writing it so it could support a movie is like this thing that's in the back of everybody's heads. Is that something you're finding, or that you something you had in the back of your head when you were writing these? Like, you know, just offhand, maybe?
Well, it's not fair to say no, but I want to be a comic book writer and not a person who, you know, creates IPs for Fox or Warner Brothers. You know, if that happens, it's great, but only in so much as it supports my comic book habit. if a No Angel TV series or movie got enough eyes on the comics that I could continue on and go past this initial 4-issue story, that's great. Or, you know, if it puts enough, you know, money in my coffers that I can afford to hire, you know, a kick-ass artist for my next project, that's great. But I'm never thinking, like, that's not the end game for me. You know, I'm not a want-to-be television writer who's doing comics because it's an easy backdoor way in. Because, first of all, that's not true. It is much harder to get traction as a comic book writer than it is as a television writer.
So, actually, you would almost think that John planned this. So something new that we've been doing on the show is the day before we record, we put a poll out on Twitter, and we get feedback from our audience, and then we like to discuss it. And this week's question was, what is your favorite non-Marvel DC Comics movie? And of course, and this is something I want to explain to our audience, Twitter only allows us to put up to 4 answers in there. So obviously I couldn't pick every non-one. So I picked the 3, which I personally thought were the most popular. And then I, you know, always give them like other comment below. And I picked The Crow, Hellboy, TMNT, and then, you know, comment below was the 4th choice. The overall winner, of course, was The Crow at 37%. Huh. Close in second place was Hellboy at 35%. And way in third place was TMNT. But it's funny because when you do something like this, you get some suggestions that, like, you don't think of, or, like, ones I thought of, but then you keep on the Chump Cast. Of course, they said The Mask. And then Jake and Tom Conquer the World. It's another podcast that listens we listen to each other. They said Ghost World, which I completely forgot about when I was putting it together. Our third co-host, who hasn't been on for a while, he said Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which is one of my favorite non-Marvel DC movies, and then Mystery Men. My issue with Mystery Men is, if you don't have the flaming carrot in it, it wasn't worth it. So Eric, what's one of your favorite non-Marvel, non-DC comic book movies?
I think I voted in your poll, and I think I said The Crow. The Crow would honestly be my answer, pulling things out of the ether. If I wasn't given an option, if there wasn't a polling option, it would have been The Crow, would have been my vote. But I'm also a big fan of Road to Perdition, which is one that a lot of people don't think about.
That was suggested as well. Also by Jake and Tom Conquer the World.
I like all the ones on your list. I assume you mean the original TMNT, the late 80s. Yes.
The late 80s, bad costumes, but still, you know, fun and the most true to the comic at the time, spirit-wise, I think.
Yeah, so that's definitely my vote, but there are a lot to choose from and a lot that people don't think about. Scott Pilgrim is another one that I adored.
That was good.
The Losers is actually, I don't think it was very well received, but I enjoyed it a great deal.
Right, but isn't that based on a DC property?
Oh, you're right. It is based on a DC Vertigo property.
Yeah.
Snowpiercer, is a good yes. movie. That's that I think a lot of people don't realize is a comic book movie because it's based on a.
Yeah, I remember I read it one night. It's off a cable or something, and my wife and I watched it. She's like, "Oh, that's a pretty good movie," and I'm like, "You know, it's based on a comic." She's like, "What? Ah, I shouldn't have watched it." She's not into all this stuff like
that. And that's a cult classic now. That's like
yes.
It's something that's on every geek's list, apparently.
Yeah, I'm sure you have ones that I didn't
like. Does manga count?
No, we'll be here all day.
I go to the show myself, but it's an animated movie.
I did not
movie.
See it yet. Oh, the animated movie.
Yeah, well,
movie.
No, you.
To say, I didn't.
Pshaw. Whitewash. I mean,
Yeah, which we've had this conversation. No one in Japan cares about
yes,
that.
I know.
That's a strictly American thing.
But the original was good. And, you know, then I literally at this right now put on the spot, I can't think of any normal stuff. So for me, it would be like One Punch Man, Ghost in the Shell. And if you're going movies, maybe Cyborg 007, because they've had a couple of movies out for him lately. That's it.
But no Pokemon.
Oh, please. Please, no.
All right. Cool. So I think we digressed enough. we are at about an hour. So one of the questions that we usually like to wrap up on, especially with new guests, the first time on, is how do you measure success?
How do I measure success?
Yes.
Oh, I mean, getting to be on Superhero Speak podcast is pretty.
Your standards are very low, my friend.
Yes,
you must aim higher. To your mother, she'll tell you.
I mean, ultimately, my goal in this medium and in this industry, and that's a discussion for maybe next time I come on, is what's the difference. But I would like someday to not have this day job, to be making enough money to income to, that my mother isn't always asking questions when I'm just at home all day making comics. Now, whether or not that ever happens, I don't know. But I can say that, you know, in the last year, I've been able to put out, you know, a full graphic novel, a series through one of my favorite indie publishers, and I got to write for Marvel. So, I mean, I'm doing pretty well. Even if I never get to quit my day job, no one can ever take away from me the fact that, you know, I'm a Marvel publisher writer.
And that's nothing to sneeze at.
Cool.
I got to write 7 words of dialogue for Thanos, which is pretty cool.
That, you know, not a lot of people can say they could do that.
Too bad it was, oh no, it's Squirrel Girl.
and you know what? It's nothing to scoff at, you know?
Just the independent stuff that you've done. I mean, okay, Marvel's a nice feather, but the fact that you've done a lot of stuff on your own, that's the big win, I think. Because that's the hard part. Was that too wise?
No, and that's once you realize that you can do it on your own, I think that's one of the – there are a handful of hurdles that I've encountered, and that's been one of the big ones, was once you realize that, you know, you don't need to be, you know, working under the auspices of Marvel or DC, and you can still do this and have, you know, modest success, you know, getting on cool podcasts or what have you, has been fantastic. So
cool.
Thanks.
I'm sure you don't know at this point, but if you do, if you have any inkling, I'm sure our listeners will want to know. You have any idea when, issue 3 of Terminal might be coming out, and when people could look for that?
Well, I hope that they'll keep an eye out. I hope they'll check out the Kickstarter rather for issues 1 and 2. Steve and Troy's plan is to do one campaign quarterly for the series, but each campaign has built into its stretch goals the next issue. So if they reach their stretch goal funding for issue 1, it will include issue 2, which will then allow them to do issues 3 and possibly 4 in the next campaign.
Oh, okay, cool.
Awesome.
You know, we're all pulling for them. And there are some fantastic creators. It's really hard for me to use that as a bargaining chip when I talk about this project, because the people that are in issues 1 and 2 are some of my favorite, you know, writers in the indie scene. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like, hey, if nothing else, let's get issues 1 and 2. Let's stretch to issue 2 so we can get to mine faster.
All right. And for everyone listening, by the time this goes up, I believe there'll be about a week left on the current Kickstarter. The link will be in the description, just like it was last week. So, again, we think this is a great project, and you guys should go support it. And as the guys were saying last week, you know, right now, you do a $10 donation, you're going to end up with over 150 pages worth of comic books, story and art for your viewing pleasure. So, can't beat that.
Nope,
right?
Can't beat it at all. And like I said, it's really good material, too. I mean, I'm biased towards issue 3, of course. And I'll have some of my digital content available as part of the issue 3 campaign in addition to my terminal story. But yeah, it's the crew that's working on issues 1 and 2 are, you know, great guys, great creators. And I'm really looking forward to, I haven't gotten to read these stories either yet, so I'm really looking forward to it.
Cool. And, before we say goodbye, what is the best way for people to find you online?
I have a website at ericpalicki.com. I am on Twitter at epalicki and on Instagram at thepalicki because someone took epalicki before I could get to it.
Oh, I wouldn't think there's that many Palickis out there.
Yeah, I found out that there is another Eric Palicki who lives in the St. Louis area, so I'm trying to plan a way to have him eliminate, you know, because just like there's it's Highlander rules with my name. So
see, I thought you were gonna like say so you can meet him and invite him to a steak dinner and get to know him.
Think of his head. Right. No. Okay, got you.
right. Once he's you know, ply him with food and alcohol, and then once he's drowsy, I'll take his head with his power.
There can be only one.
Exactly.
Cool. All right, so I believe that's a good place to put a pin in it for this week. So remember, boys and girls, there can be only one Eric. And until next time, as always, don't let your cape get caught in the door. Have a good week.
Thanks, guys.
Are you strong enough to stop a stupid movie rumor?
Are you more powerful than a bad comic book event?
Are you able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have got absolutely nothing better to do?
Then join the conversation by connecting with us on Facebook, Twitter, Slack, and other social media platforms.
And help us get our capes from getting stuck in the door by becoming an official Patreon patron.
And if you just want more content from us, don't forget to check out our website where we post way more than we can discuss here.
So what are you waiting for? When you join our fight, everyone wins.